gradual training in the Noble Eightfold Path, which is again right effort. And that means in particular how to deal with the mind. And this is very interesting because dealing with the mind is obviously some of the most difficult things, because the mind is so fast and the thoughts arise before you can kind of you have a chance to be properly mindful and aware of what is going on. So this is a very important part of the Buddhist path, to be able to deal with the mind. And this is really the only way that in the end you're going to be able to get some really powerful meditation, is if you deal with the mind in the right way. And this is really where it all is, almost like the crux of the matter in some ways. So for that reason, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on this. Many of the suttas I do on every retreat, because I really like these suttas. Personally, I like to read the same thing again and again and again. And I hope you're the same, otherwise it's going to be problematic. And this, the first sutta I'm going to read out, is called Two Kinds of Thought. And it is gives a kind of bit of a background and a kind of general framework for how to deal with the thinking mind. And I really like the sutta. It's very rich and has a lot of implications, a lot of things going on here. And for that reason, I really like this one. This is one of those autobiographical suttas where the Buddha talks about his own life before his awakening, how he actually got there. And again, the idea, obviously, with this kind of sutta is to inspire us, to kind of give us this feeling that, this Buddha says, I did this, you should be practicing in the same way. I am human, you are human, so what we need to do to get to the goal is exactly the same thing. It's not different just because I happen to be the Buddha or become the Buddha eventually. It is still the same path that leads to the same place. So this is what the Buddha does, and this is one of the reasons why this is obviously quite interesting. And this is how it goes. This is Majjhima Nikaya number 19, Dveda Vitakka Sutta in Pali here. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. So here we have a typical start of the suttas, right? When it starts off, many of the longer suttas, they start off with thus have I heard. And what that means, the reason why it is spoken in this, put in this way, is because this is an oral tradition. It is passed down orally from one generation to generation. And this difference here is between thus have I heard, and the alternative is this is what I have seen for myself, or this is what I have heard directly. That is really the distinction here. So sometimes you will hear people like Venerable Ananda, he will say, I have heard this in the presence of the Blessed One. From the Blessed One's own lips I have heard this. And that is a difference between the thus have I heard. Thus have I heard shows you it's been passed down through the generations. You weren't present yourself when these things happened. So it is something that has been passed on traditionally. That is the meaning of that. And then typically all the suttas start off with, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati. Savati, one of the places where the Buddha spent most of his time. It's called Jeta's Grove because, according to tradition, I'm not sure, this is not really recorded in the earlier suttas, but according to tradition, it was owned by a prince called Jeta. And he was a prince, he was one of the sons, I think, probably, of King Pasenadi of Kosala, who was the king. The king also lived in Savati in those days. And the prince owned this grove called Jeta's Grove. And then when the Buddha was going towards Savati for the first time, there was this merchant called Anathapindika who was extremely wealthy. And he decided, I have to find a nice place for the Buddha to stay when he comes to Savati. And he said, what would be a nice place? And idea of a nice place is somewhere which is not too close to the city and not too far away. It's easy to access to go on alms round, right? So you can go on alms round. But then when you retire, you get away from the hustle and bustle of the city and town life. So there's that middle way, finding somewhere convenient. And Jeta's Grove happened to be just right. But Prince Dreta, he did not want to sell his grove right here. This is like the landed aristocracy. They hold on to their land. They don't want to give up their land. And but Antapindika is very determined. So he says, well, what if I cover every... This is a legend, right? This is not, I don't think this is what really happened, but this is the legend behind this. What if I cover every square centimeters of this land with gold? Will you then sell it? And Prince Jet, I thought, this, he will never be able to do that. It was a large piece of land. But then he actually is able to do that. And that's how he gets his property, according to the legend. So, and then after that, he was pretty poor, the poor Antapindika, because he spent all this money buying this land. So again, a lot of very powerful faith and confidence in the Buddha. And this is what kind of drives him to do this. So the Buddha was living there, and if you go to Savatthi in the present day, you can actually go to this particular place. It has been kind of discovered by archaeologists. Almost all the ancient Buddhist places have been discovered through archaeology. And you can go, it's actually quite nice to go to Savatthi. It's quite peaceful there, except these days there's so many tourists. They are sometimes very noisy, these tourists. You've got to find the right time to go there early in the morning or something. Because they come and they have loudspeakers and blaring out sermons and chanting, and then you get 10 tourist buses of one group, right? 300 people belonging to one group, and they're not going to be quiet, that's absolutely certain. So that's the unfortunate thing about the kind of these places in India. They're becoming more and more touristified. That's the kind of the downside of the Indian government wants to kind of make money out of these things, which is kind of fair enough. We can see why that's the case, but it has a downside if you are a Buddhist. But still, it is nice to go to these places. I find at least once in a lifetime to go and see where the Buddha was, the places that he... And you get some kind of connection with Buddhism. You get a very strong connection when you go there. And, well, for many reasons. First of all, you know that this is where the Buddha was. And secondly, you recognize the places from the suttas. You see the description in the suttas of Rajagaha, for example. Rajagaha is this fort city in the middle of seven mountains. There's mountains or big hills on all sides of Rajagaha. And then the city or the town. It was really just towns in those days. They weren't all that large. A few thousand, perhaps a few tens of thousands of inhabitants. It wasn't very large. But this Rajagaha was situated in these mountains. That's how it's described in the suttas. Rajagaha was also called Giribhadra. Giribhadra means like the hill fort. It was fortified by hills all the way around it. And you see the ancient fortifications, the kind of big stone walls going around the hills. So it looks exactly as it described in the suttas. That's exactly what it looks like when you go there. You go to the Vulture's Peak, right? The Vulture's Peak is in Rajagaha. And you can kind of see the shape of the vulture when you're there. You go to the hot springs. There's a place called the hot springs at the base of one of the mountains. It is described in the suttas that the monks would go there to bathe, that the king would go there to bathe, right? It's very interesting. It tells you how small scale everything was. The king would kind of go to one of the hot springs to bathe when the monks were there. And according to this one story, monks were bathing, and then the king arrived to bathe, and then the king was very polite, so he kind of waited for the monks to finish. And then by the time the monks had finished, it was already late. So when the king got back to the city, the gates of the city had closed. So the king had to spend the night outside the city. You get this feeling of things being very kind of simple in those days. That kind of sounds almost unheard of in the present day for something like that to happen. Then he goes and complains to the Buddha. He says, I had to sleep outside the city because your monks are being kind of, were just bathing and bathing and bathing. And then the Buddha has to lay down some rules about, how often you can bathe, that kind of stuff. This is how rules came into being in those days. But very fascinating, because when you go to these hot springs, when you go to exactly the same spot today, what do you find? You find hot springs. And today it's a bit more elaborate, it's kind of proper bath and things, but you have all this Indian, all the local people, they're still bathing in those hot springs. It's kind of astonishing. After 2,500 years, right, things are pretty much exactly the same as they were at the time of the Buddha. And there's many things like that when you travel around India. You travel to Benares, Varanasi, as it is called in India. It is also called Kasi in the suttas. And lo and behold, you find people in India today who called Benares, who called it Kasi. Yeah, so I spoke to our Indian monk in our monastery, Venerable Nibhuto. He is actually a Sikh originally, but he's from India. He's from the Punjab, the north west of India. But he said that in his grandfather called Benares, he called it Kasi, right? So you can see how, again, these things are there. And then when you go to Kasi and you go, it is today, it is still one of the kind of capitals of India, of certain luxury goods like cloth and that sort of thing. And of course, at the time of the Buddha too, it was the place where you got luxury goods, like really nice cloth and that sort of thing. And you see the connection. And when you see that connection, you get a very strong feeling that the suttas are real historical documents who talk about things that happened. Sometimes you read the suttas, you're not really sure. It's hard to kind of really see them as historical documents. This, you know, you're a bit uncertain about what these things really are. But when you see that connection there, they become much more alive. And you get the feeling for the Buddha as a real person who wandered around 2,500 years ago. Sometimes you're not really sure where the legend begins and where the real person stops. But in this way, you're actually building up this perception, this feeling of somebody real existing at the time of the Buddha. And that kind of gives you more, everything becomes more tangible that way, more, you know, you can relate to it much better as a consequence. So this is the advantage of doing these things and going to India, seeing some of these things. It makes everything much more real. And so on this occasion then, at Anathapindika, in Anathapindika's parak, he addressed the monks. And this is kind of the standard way things start out in the suttas. He says, Bhikkhus, and they say, Venerable Sir, Badante, they reply here. And then the Blessed One speaks. And all of this, this part that you have just seen now, that is what we would normally call the narrative framework of the sutta. Only very little, little short paragraph, which gives you the, sets the scene, so to speak, for what comes afterwards. And what is interesting about this is that the narrative framework was obviously added later on. The main part of the sutta, which is what we're going to start now in a second, that is the real teaching, that is what the Buddha taught, that is what those who were present would have heard when they were there. But this other part that we have just seen, that was added at a later stage. Because it talks about the situation. And we know from the Buddhist tradition that a lot of this was added at the first council, the first communal recitation of the suttas, because there it is said, you know, where did this happen? Who were talking? And this kind of thing. So that is later. So that is already, you could arguably, slightly less reliable, because it is added after the fact. And yet even that so-called unreliable information often turns out to be very quite reliable. It fits with the historical facts, etc. But the essence of the Dhamma is always when the Buddha speaks, and that is what the monks would have remembered from the very beginning. And that is the most important part here. So this is what the Buddha has to say. Bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. Yeah, so this is how this thing starts off. And there's a lot of interesting things going on already here. First of all, it starts off with the Buddha calling himself a bodhisattva. Yeah, so here he says, before my awakening, in other words, this is the Buddha to be, the Buddha to, you know, he's not the Buddha yet, but he's kind of moving in that direction. And he calls himself a bodhisattva. And sometimes you come to these words in the suttas and you wonder, how come the word bodhisattva is here? I thought bodhisattva was kind of Mahayana Buddhism. Or if it wasn't Mahayana, at least it was later part of Theravada Buddhism. Why? How come this is found in the suttas? And It is interesting, isn't it, why it actually is there? And of course, the point is that very often the words that are used later on in Mahayana Buddhism, in later Theravada Buddhism, the words are actually often found in the suttas, but the meaning of the words change over time. So they gain another meaning as time passes by. So for that reason, we have to be very careful when we see a word like bodhisatta. We have to read it as to how it is used in the suttas, and not kind of use later ideas and kind of project that back into the suttas, because if you do that, you get the wrong meaning out of this. So this word bodhisatta in the suttas is used quite specifically to mean the Buddha, not the Buddha to be, after his going forth, right, when he decided that he's going to search for an end to suffering, an end to old age and death and all of these kind of things. From the moment he decides to go forth, that is really when the Buddha is called the Bodhisatta in the suttas. And he calls himself that. So that is what that means. There are some exceptions to that. Some of you may have heard of the Acharya Bhutta Sutta, the wonderful and marvelous Majjhima Nikaya 123, where you have all the marvelous events that kind of happened around the Buddha's birth and all of these kind of things. And there, the word bodhisatta is kind of stretched back a little further back. That sutta is much more. It is not as consistent with kind of other parallels and that sort of thing. So I don't take everything in that sutta quite as seriously as I do in other suttas. So you have to be a little bit kind of circumspect how you use these suttas. But that is the essential meaning. So it's a very different meaning from what you have in later Buddhism. It only has to do with what happens in the very last life of the Buddha after his going forth. So why is it called the bodhisatta? What is the reason for that? Very often you may have heard, often in Mahayana Buddhism, they use the word bodhisattva, right? And bodhisattva means a being. So bodhi means awakening. So bodhisattva means like awakening being. Awakening being is kind of slightly strange, right? Awakening being is not really sure what that means. What does that mean? Does that mean he's already awakened? What does it mean he's searching for? What exactly does that mean? So the meaning of the word bodhisatta, where you don't have a V, could be actually quite different from that. And it has been suggested by some people who are scholars of Sanskrit and Pali and these kind of things that perhaps the more likely meaning of this word is not bodhisattva, but bodhisakta. And bodhisakta is a Sanskrit word that means like intent on or searching for or that sort of thing. So it means the one who is intent on or searching for awakening. Suddenly it falls into place, right? It makes much better sense. That kind of fits the context really well. That is how I know that Adan Sujato, he's now translating bodhisatta in that way, as the one who is intent on awakening here, because it fits the context and everything much better here. So, of course, that changes the outlook also in many ways. And so that is the idea of bodhisatta in Pali. And then you are unawakened. This, of course, is another important aspect of this. While you are still searching for awakening, you haven't actually reached that awakening yourself yet. You don't really, you're unsure about what is going on. You haven't got right view yet. And that's why the Buddha-to-be is also fumbling around a little bit in the dark. He doesn't really know exactly where he's heading. That's why he makes so many mistakes on the way. Why he kind of practices austerities. He almost dies practicing austerities, right? He takes it to the very extreme. That is precisely because of this lack of awakening, lack of understanding. And that is kind of one of the big problems with the whole bodhisattva ideal, the ideal that you are practicing a path that leads to awakening, because you don't know what awakening is. You're not awakened yet. You haven't seen the truth. Because you haven't seen the truth, you don't know, you are in the dark. So how can you practice a path when you don't really know what's going on? It doesn't really work all that well. The theory doesn't really seem to work all that well, in my opinion. Anyway, so this is the Buddha before his awakening, right? He is now trying to practice the path to find an end of the problems in life, find an end to suffering, an end to birth, old age and death and these kind of things. So he's just exactly where everyone else is at. And then so this is why he becomes, his practice becomes an example to the rest of us. And this is what he thinks, right? Before his awakening. He thinks, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. And then he divides his thinking into kind of the bad thoughts, the ones that lead away from awakening, the ones that are defiled on the one hand, and then the pure kind of thoughts on the other hand. Yeah, this is what he does. And it may sound simple. It may sound kind of, okay, you know, big deal, right? But actually, how many of us have actually ever thought like that? Certainly when before I became a Buddhist, I never thought like that. I never thought, oh, let me divide my thoughts into two classes, right? Never ever occurred to me. But when you read it, it kind of makes really good sense. But somehow it never occurs to you. It takes someone with kind of superior wisdom and superior kind of conditioning from the past. And perhaps also because he lives in a society where people think in this way. Yeah, he lives in India. India being a very religious society where you have wise people and also stupid people, of course, but all kinds of people wandering around practicing the path. And then you listen to those people to see what they have to say. So being in the right place, I think, also matters enormously. And India has always had that ascetic tradition. People going for practicing samadhi, going a long way on the path already, even though they may not get fully awakened, they go a long way on that path. But where I was born, right, in Norway, that is kind of one of the least religious societies on the planet. People are completely materialistic. All they care about is kind of the latest BMW and that kind of stuff. And what, you know, the chances of thinking like this are virtually zero because there's no input to think in this particular way. So Norway is kind of, you know, the spiritual backwaters of the world if you're born in that kind of place. So you can see where you are born actually matters a little bit. And so, sometimes you go to India, you think, oh, I'm so glad I got born in the West or wherever, because, wow, the people are so poor. You know, imagine living like this. But I think sometimes we get a skewed outlook. Sometimes we see only one side of the picture. But there's another side to that picture, which also is very powerful and has a lot to be commended for it. And that is kind of the spiritual side of the Indian people. A lot of delusion in that spirituality, but also a few really wise people among all the problems. So this is one of the things that I always found very fascinating about India, is this. It is so different from the way I grew up. When I grew up, completely non-religious. Nothing at all. People always ask me you must have grown up as a Christian, right? Because you were born in a Christian country. Nobody in Norway is Christian, right? People, there's no religion anymore. That's completely gone out of the window a long time ago. Okay. And even if you are Christian, it doesn't really necessarily help you all that much. Okay, so he divides his thoughts into two classes, right? And this is, of course, a very interesting thing. And then he has these negative thoughts, the sensual desire, the ill will, and the cruelty. Yeah, we all know about these things already. These are kind of the root defilements, the root wrong perception, the root thoughts that are so problematic on the Buddhist path. Cruelty, the last one there, is not a very good translation. It is vihinsa, or hinsa is the word behind that. And it means more like being harmful, yeah? Being pitiless, being hard-hearted, being ruthless, that kind of stuff. It doesn't necessarily mean that you kind of enjoy killing or that sort of stuff. It just means that you don't really care about the consequences of your actions. You are ruthless. Okay, if my actions lead to other people suffering, I don't care. This is about me. I'm going to do what I need to do in my life. Like the ruthless business person or something like that. So that is the one side of the thought. And then the other side is the opposite of that. Renunciation here means giving up the sensual pleasures in the world. Not giving them up in a sense of that you can't You don't use them at all, but giving them up in a sense that you don't have any attachment to these things. You don't really have any craving for these things because you're looking towards a higher kind of happiness. Non-ill will, right? The idea of metta, but also the idea of equanimity, upeka, is also included in that. And then non-cruelty, or abhimsa, or ahimsa, which is the kind of the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi, right? Same kind of philosophy here. And the idea of being harmless in the world, having a sense of compassion, is what that is about. So the Buddha-to-be, he divides the world, divides his thinking mind into these things. And then the very next sentence, on the next paragraph, I'll just read one little phrase there. It says that as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Yeah. Well, first of all, these words that we see here, diligent, ardent, and resolute, these words are appamada, atapi, and pahitatta, are the words there. And these words don't actually quite, I don't really like this translation all that much. I think appamada means more like being heedful. In other words, being careful, being circumspect, being, you know, thinking about what you're doing before you're doing, having yoniso manasikara, wise attention, all of these things. That is what appamada means. Diligent to me is like somebody who works really hard. It's like an ant, right? An ant is diligent, working really hard. But an ant does not have appamada, yeah? But it's diligent. But it's not really circumspect. It just kind of works without really thinking about it. So this is, don't be like an ant, be more like somebody who is a spiritual person. So appamada, heedful. Atapi is here ardent, and ardent is not necessarily wrong, but it's just a very obscure word. Nobody knows what ardent means. It's kind of really, you know, you have to look up, you have to have your Oxford English Dictionary next to you to figure out what these words mean. But atapi just means energetic, really. It means putting forth effort. That is really what it is about. So you put forth effort. So having energy and resolute, pahitatta, is also related very much to what we are looking at now. Pahitatta is related to the word padana. Padana means effort. Sixth factor on the Noble Eightfold Path, samma padana, right effort. And that word is directly related to that. So it means having effort. So what this means, basically, is that you put forth a certain amount of effort, but a heedful, careful, circumspect kind of effort, where you are doing things in the right way. So, and of course, what is interesting here is that he says, as I abided thus with effort. So what he's referring to is what he has just said. So what is that effort? And that effort, you will see, therefore, is precisely the fact that you are dividing your thinking mind into two classes. That is that effort. Yeah, so when we talk about right effort on the Buddhist path, of course, this ability to divide your thinking mind into two classes is all about wisdom. It's all about insight. It's all about yoniso manasikara. So right effort means that. It means wisdom, it means insight, it means understanding. It does not mean using willpower, applying yourself with kind of gritting your teeth and clenching your fist and this kind of stuff. It means actually being wise. And this is one of the first places that I remember reading that. Sometimes you read these things and you read them too fast, and you're not able to take on board these kind of subtler points. But after you've read it 100 times, I had to read it like 99 times before I got this. And on the 100th time, after you have digested everything else, these small things start to stand out. I think, wait a minute, what's going on here? And actually, you realize that it is because... and also, of course, getting the conditioning from Ajahn Brahma. Ajahn Brahma was very big on wisdom power rather than willpower. Right? And then you start to see these things. And you see how it all fits together very nicely. So that is what it means to have effort, as a wise kind of effort that you are using here. And it may seem, once you have understood the idea of dividing your thoughts into two classes, it may seem obvious, but of course it isn't really. It isn't obvious because we know the coarser aspects of bad thoughts, the coarser aspects of good thoughts. We know about that because it is quite obvious. If you have strong sense of ill will or negativity, you know, you feel it inside so easily. But what is hard is to see the refined manifestations of these things. When kind of the ill will is very subtle, or the desire is very, very subtle, you can almost can't see it. You are just attached to something, right? Your mind doesn't go deeper in meditation. Why does it not go deeper? And you can't really figure it out. You try to see why doesn't it go deeper. And there's a subtle attachment there to the sensual world that stops you from letting go and therefore from going deeper. This is the kind of thing that we are looking out for. So you're holding on to your body, or you're not willing to let go of the of your ability to see, right? But you have to let go of all seeing. That is what we mean by attachment here. You're attached to the very idea of being able to see, or to hear, or to feel. This is the idea of sensuality in this most profound sense. So very, very subtle. Yeah, so you have to kind of be able to give up sight completely. Okay, I'm going to be blind forever after. That's fine, because I'm moving into a much greater happiness. That's almost the kind of thing you have to do. That is why it can seem difficult. But of course, the idea here is that as you walk that path, because you see the happiness that comes from giving up, that is what makes it easy to do, even though it may sound difficult to begin with. So this is actually much more profound than it may seem, and this is why so much of the path is about meditate, reflect on your meditation, why the satipatthanas are all about overcoming the refined problems of the mind, the refined hindrances that are blocking you. That is what satipatthana practice really is about. And it becomes very clear once you read the Satipatthana Sutta. We're not going to be doing it on this retreat because I'm trying to do things a little bit differently every time, but it is certainly there if you read it. So that is the first thing, right? Dividing your thought into these things. And then once he has done that, made that division, then he can start to deal with the negative thinking. And this is what comes next. So he says, as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. It leads to my own affliction, suffering, right? To others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered it obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So this is how you deal with the defilements of the mind, right? Here you are. This is how the Buddha says we should do things. And of course, what is so interesting about this method, there's nothing here about suppressing anything. There's nothing here about using willpower to achieve anything. It is all about thinking about it in the right way. That is what it's all about. It's all about wisdom. It's all about being smart, all about insight. That is how you overcome these things. And you will remember that, you know, the sutta I was quoting yesterday or the day before or whenever, it all blurs into one mass of days after a while. Not to see what happened when. But the sutta talks about the two powers, right? The power of reflection and the power of development. And this here is precisely about the power of reflection. The power of reflection is always about how to overcome the negative tendencies of body, speech, and mind. And this is what we are doing here, by reflecting in the right way. It is very, very, very interesting because it gives us very clear directions how to overcome these things. And I will show you in a second why this is so important and why this is far more powerful than suppression, using willpower, trying to hold things in check and all that kind of stuff. This is so hard to do that. And I'll describe that in a second as we go through this. The first thing then is to understand that the sensual desire has arisen, right? This is the third part, it's the first part, and that, of course, already is sometimes easy, but sometimes actually is very hard, because it is so subtle, these things. And then the second thing to do, once you have understood that there is a problem, right, we're talking about sati and sampajanya. The sati is aware that something has happened. Okay, sensual desire has arisen, that's sati. Sampajanya, it tells you that this is not really going to work. It is not purposeful. It's not going to lead in the right direction. So sampajanya arises. And then Yoniso Manasikara comes and says, okay, now what do we do with this? And Yoniso Manasikara gives you the tool to deal with that. And that tool here is precisely this. This is the Yoniso Manasikara, is that it leads to my own affliction. It leads to my own suffering. It leads to my own problems. That is Yoniso Manasikara. Yeah. But it's not just thinking that it leads to my own affliction. It's actually understanding that. You can think that as much as you like on a superficial way. It's not going to do anything. But you really have to understand that that's the case. And when you understand that, when you feel it in a deep sense, that is when it works. So why is it that sensual desires, sensual pleasures lead to suffering? What is the reason for that? And again, it's one of those things that is quite hard to see, because normally we enjoy our sensual world to some extent. And I should say straight away that to me it is far more important to focus on the ill will and the harmfulness side of things. That is far more important, because that is where the real harm is and the real problems are. If you want to focus a little bit on sensual desire, you can do that as well. But first of all, the ill will is most important to deal with, and then we can deal with sensual desires afterwards. But this sutta starts with sensual desire, and I think the reason is because it is the same sequence as you see in the five hindrances. There's a certain standardization in the suttas there. So how do we do this? Just to give you a brief idea, I'm going to talk more about this later on, but just some brief hints at why this is a problem. One reason it is a problem is because every time there is sensual desire, there is attachment. As long as there is attachment, there is going to be suffering in the future. You're attached to something, eventually it will have to go. So every time you have a thought of sensual desire, you're also asking for some degree of suffering in the future. This is one of them, one of the problems. Another problem is that the sensual things of the world, they are limited. Often we compete over the same things, right? We compete over partners, we compete over promotions, we compete, sometimes we compete over things directly in front of us if there isn't enough of something, like a child, competing over a toy or a piece of, biscuit or something like that. And all of these things happen all the time. Competition is driven in large part by sensual desire. And then we create problems out of that. So these are just some examples. But ultimately, the main reason why this is a really big problem is that sensual desire is the main thing that binds us to samsaric existence. Sensual pleasures are always about the future. An inherent part of sensual pleasures is desire, is craving. This idea that you're always searching a future state. And because you're always searching for a future state, you keep this samsaric cycle going. You're always projecting into the future one way or another. So this is by far the most important source of attachment to samsaric existence. And this is, of course, a very big problem with sensual pleasures. That basically, we are perpetuating suffering endlessly into the future, as long as we hold on to these sensual pleasures too much. So when you start thinking like this, you start to realize, yes, this really is for my own suffering, right? Every time I think about this, I'm adding another knot to the rope that ties me to samsara. That's essentially what it's like. Yeah. So do you want to add another knot? Or do you want to loosen some of those knots or some of those shackles that are binding you to samsaric existence? That is really the choice there. But as always, to be able to really appreciate these things, you have to reflect on them. Yeah. Again, about wisdom power, reflecting on these things. And then as you reflect on them, they become more part of your psychology, part of who you are. And gradually, you are changing your viewpoint and looking at the whole world in a different way. This is quite challenging, and it takes a lot of perseverance and persistence to do this sort of stuff, because we are so used to the pleasures of the world. They are so much part of our life, and it takes a lot of modeling our view of the world. But gradually, it's possible to overcome these things. But allow it to be natural. Don't force these things. If you force it too much, you're just going to suffer endlessly because of this. The idea is not to suffer. The idea is just to use wisdom so as to effect a natural change. That is what it is about. Then, of course, it leads to the suffering of others, right? To other people's affliction. So if we want to be kind and compassionate in the world, sensual desire is problematic. Why? Because we compete over things. When we have sensual desire, we have vested interest, we have attachments. We're no longer looking out for what is good for other people, we're looking out for what is good for us. That is the very nature of sensual pleasures. And it is problematic for both, yeah? It is not just one or the other. Actually, it is problematic both for myself and for others when we attach to these things, when we have these kind of desires. So for everyone, it's not as if I can be a martyr, right? Martyr, and then I will sacrifice myself for the benefit of others. It doesn't work that way, because it is bad for both. And that is kind of the idea here. Yeah? So the last thought is that it obstructs wisdom. Yeah, panya nirodhika, it makes wisdom cease. And if you are keen on wisdom, I think most sensible people would like to be wise. Wise is like the highest faculty on the Buddhist path. To my mind, very beautiful idea of being wise, because when you are wise, that is when you can make decisions that lead away from suffering and towards happiness. Wisdom is precisely this ability, ultimately, to be more happy in the world, have less problems, have less suffering. That is what wisdom really is about. And that is why it is such a beautiful thing. So anything that obstructs wisdom, makes wisdom cease, is bad news, right? It's really terrible. If you understand the importance of this, it is something that is really, really negative. So when you have sensual desire, your mind is kind of warped. It is distorted. You cannot see straight. Causes difficulties. Something like agata means like difficulties. So it's problematic. In other words, it is also inherently painful. When you have sensual desire, it is inherently painful because it leads to agitation and restlessness and all of these kind of things. And the last one, it leads away from Nibbana. So that Nibbana, it means like extinguishment on the Buddhist path. You want to extinguish stuff, extinguish anger, extinguish greed. Right? So you are, instead of going towards extinguishment of these things, you are moving towards more fires being lit instead. This is what one of the metaphors in the suttas for the defilements, they are fires. The fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. They are restless, they're like flames moving inside you. They're hot. You feel heated when you get angry, right? And this kind of stuff. So you are moving away from that. And Nibbana is cool, extinguished. You feel at ease. You feel mindful in the world. You feel at peace. The anti-Nibbana is the opposite, is the kind of the negative of all of that. So Nibbana is very beautiful. You may think that I don't know what Nibbana is, but you do already to some extent know what Nibbana is, because you know degrees of this. lesser degrees. And that is sufficient to give you some idea what is going on. So this is how you reflect, right? And when you reflect like this, then it disappears. And this is kind of the interesting thing at the very end there. It says that whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it. Sometimes this is translated as I obliterated it. Right? Obliteration is kind of very, something very, kind of, sounds very willful. You obliterate something. And all of these words, removing it, doing away with it, obliterating it, annihilating things, give this feeling that you're using a lot of power to make these things disappear. And this is where we have to be so careful, because we have to remember that translations are uncertain, the exact meaning of things are uncertain. What does it actually mean to obliterate something in the Pali Suttas? What does it mean to annihilate things? These words are actually also used elsewhere to describe this. It sounds like we've got to go in there and use incredible amount of willpower to make these things end. But the reality is, as we see here, that obliteration does not mean that at all. Obliteration means precisely using wisdom, using yonisomanasikara, thinking about things in the right way. That is how these things are obliterated. And in fact, and this is the really important point that I said I was going to talk about a few minutes ago, the really important point here is that you cannot actually obliterate anything here. You cannot remove anything. You cannot do away with something using willpower. Willpower can never do that. All that willpower can ever do is kind of hold things down, hold things in check, right? You hold it in check, and as soon as you stop holding it in check, you remove your hands, bang, it comes back into your face again. So willpower never removes things properly. Willpower just kind of holds things, suppresses them for a while. As soon as you let go of the suppression, bang, it comes back and hits you in the face again. And this is the problem with willpower. It is only wisdom power that actually has the ability to obliterate something. Because when you turn your mind to the danger in something and you see that it really is dangerous, then what happens? That your mind turns away from these things all by itself, because you know that this is going to be suffering for you. If you know that something is going to be suffering for you, you just don't go there. The mind is repelled by that, and it goes in a different direction. And then when it goes in a different direction, that defilement that you had, that will then disappear for a long period of time afterwards. And that is what we mean by obliterating things. It happens through wisdom power, not through willpower. And that is such good news, right? It's wonderful news, because willpower is often painful to use a lot of willpower all the time. Willpower tires you out. You have a job where you have to kind of focus, to concentrate all the time. And after a while, oh, you're so tired, you come back home and you just veg out in front of the TV or whatever because you had enough. And that sort of stuff, it makes you tired. And the same thing, if you use willpower in your meditation to hold on to the object, because otherwise the sensual desires will overrun the mind or the negativity or whatever, if you use that, after a while you get tired, you lose your energy. And when you lose your energy, your ability to stay with anything gets even worse. So it doesn't work, willpower. What works instead is the wisdom power. And that wisdom power, to make it work, you have to build it up gradually. You have to reflect on why sensual pleasures is a real problem. And as you build up that perception in your mind, you create a perception, you put it on your little shelf. You have a shelf in your mind, right, with various perceptions. Shelf, one shelf called metta, one called compassion, one called anti-sensual desire, one called how to be friendly with this particular person who I don't like, right? That kind of perception. So you have this shelf, and then when the bad thought arises, you quickly go to that shelf, pull it down, okay, bang, and you put on the reality distortion, not the reality, you put on the reality clarification glasses to make things clear. That's how you do those things. So this is the idea of using wisdom power. Yeah, wisdom power is something we need to work on all the time. But once you have those perceptions established in your mind, they are very, very powerful, and they enable you to overcome things so fast and so easily. So the hard part with wisdom power is the reflection, is the thinking about things, being careful, scrutinizing things in the right way. That is the difficult thing with wisdom power. And that is where you have to put in the work. But it doesn't require willpower in the same way as we might think it does. Okay, so that is the sensual desire. Then we have pretty much the same paragraph on ill will and also on harming, right? So I'll just read through this quickly. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, and then a thought of harming arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of harming has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of harming arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So again, the same principle. Now this time, ill will, right? Why is ill will problematic? I think we all know why ill will is problematic. So it's easier to gain the incentive and the motivation to get rid of ill will, because it causes so many problems in life, interpersonal problems, wars, conflict within families, within societies, within the whole globe. If you're going to have intergalactic war, that probably comes from ill will as well. Everything comes from that. So many problems arise from ill will. It's just so obvious that is the case. And we know that if you are a person who is gentle and kind, people tend to like you as well. People, if somebody has too much ill will, you almost don't want to be too close to that person. It's kind of almost painful to be in their presence. And this is another problem with ill will. So many problems there, and I think it is fairly obvious, but still, even though it is fairly obvious, it is good to reflect on the negative things of ill will sometimes. Harming, the same kind of thing, the harming here means the hard mind, the mind that doesn't care, right? That kind of mind state is also very unconducive on the path, because the path of Buddhism, you need a soft mind, a gentle mind. The mind that goes into samadhi is kind of a strange dichotomy of qualities. On the one hand, a very strong mind, very kind of solid. On the other hand, also gentle at the same time. It's a kind of strange combination of qualities, right, we're talking about. That is kind of the weird thing about samadhi. You, on the one hand, very gentle, on the other hand, very, very strong and firm at the same time. And in a sense, a very attractive combination of qualities, once you understand what they actually are. So that is these qualities, and you abandon those in exactly the same way as you did with the previous one, with the sensual desire. Then we have this simile. I'm going to skip one paragraph and get back to a paragraph afterwards. I'll just read out the simile, first of all, because the simile relates to what we have just been talking about. So just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that, with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let those cows stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states or unwholesome qualities the danger, degradation, defilement, and in the wholesome qualities the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Yeah, so the cow here, the cow is the mind, right? The mind is the cows, and the cows, the mind always wants to wander into the sensual pleasures. Imagine if you're a cow, you have to eat grass all the time, and then you see the crops on the other side of the fence. You think, whoa, look at those beautiful, beautiful crops over there. I want to eat those instead, right? So you have to be careful as a cowherd, because otherwise you're going to get really seriously blamed and imprisoned or whatever if you allow those crops to go in there. So you watch your mind, you guard your mind, you use a certain degree of mindfulness to watch them. And then once you have the mindfulness, you tap them a little bit. This is the effort that you use, is the wisdom effort in this particular case. And then you avoid all the punishment that comes from allowing them to stray into the crops. And in the same way, I saw in unwholesome states the danger, right? This is what we have been looking at just now. The degradation. This is kind of interesting, the word degradation. Okara, it literally means to make something low. It's like you are lowering yourself down. You feel almost like less of a human being. Yeah, you know what it's like if you are, sometimes you get really, your mind gets very defiled or whatever. And sometimes it kind of makes you feel almost like dirty. It feels like you feel less, right, than what you could be than when your mind is more purified and more refined. And so this is like lowering yourself down, making yourself less of a kind of full human being, if you want. This is the degradation of the mind. Defilement, similar kind of thing, right? But the wholesome states, the wholesome qualities have the opposite idea. You renounce those things, and when you renounce that, you have this aspect of purity or cleansing of the mind. And a pure mind is very pleasant. It's a very happy state to be when the mind is pure. It is, you feel really good about yourself. You feel happy. Otherwise, it can sound a bit maybe perhaps puritanical, right? Puritanical is also derived from purity, but it's a negative idea of purity. Here it is the real purity of the heart, and it's a very beautiful and wonderful state to be there. And you all know that to some extent, because you all have sufficient experience in meditation or on this path to know that purity is something very positive. Anyway, I've been going on for an hour already, so I'm going to stop there, and then we can continue, finish off this beautiful sutta at 3 o'clock. So I'll see you again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.